They looked at blood glucose levels, looked at insulin levels, looked at HbA1c and whatnot. And they showed that they were able to put diabetes into remission in these individuals.
Nicholas, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Yeah, the honor is all mine. I'm very excited to go. Anytime I can talk science, I'm in.
Absolutely. I think before we start, there's a few things that the audience should know about you. The first being that you are a scientist who has been able to promote an educational message about health sciences in a way that very few scientists have been able to do. And that is by generating curiosity and, importantly, addressing these health science topics with a degree of rigor that they really deserve. And that's something that I think very few scientists have been able to accomplish in this space. You also bring a wide range of general expertise in human biology through your PhD training, your Master's of Kinesiology, and your trainer certifications, as well as more specific expertise in mitochondria and autophagy. And I want to get into those topics as our discussion goes on in this episode. But first, I want to know about you and what inspired you to go into science and science education.
Well, first off, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's something that I work at tirelessly to try to communicate, you know, scientific information without losing too much of the detail, because you have a lot of pop science channels that are out there, which I know, as a matter of fact, your channel is very focused on getting to the nitty-gritty science as well, which I deeply respect, and I think that we need more of that. So let me throw that back at you. In terms of how I started and everything, it really started, I suppose, after my undergrad. So I'd finished my degree in psychology, so nothing related to you know, physiology and whatnot. And but I was obsessively reading about physiology, and then I decided to go back to school for a physiology degree, nutrition science degree and whatnot, and just kind of went through that journey of taking classes and whatnot, going to undergrad and whatnot. And I constantly found myself extremely unsatisfied with the amount of information that I was learning. I wanted to learn at a faster rate than what was being offered to me through my classes, which then I thought to myself, well, I might as well make this publicly available for people, so that they can also learn with me, essentially, as I'm going through this this journey. And I've made a specific point not to ever dumb anything down. Obviously, when it comes to science communication, you have to understand that some people don't have a biology degree, so you kind of have to piece together little things that they probably know, like the word mitochondria, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But people know mitochondria, powerhouse of the cell, for example, so you can grab onto that and make a network of information for them, of education for them. So that was essentially it. I wanted to take really complex studies, break them down into understandable terms so that people would feel like they can have intellectual input on you know, the science landscape as a whole. And in terms of, yeah, the health landscape in general, I think that I would kind of put it into three different buckets. So one, you have kind of the pop science channels that have the little, like the glitzy, I don't know, like these different animations and stuff that pop up. They'll say like, mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell, very happy and all that with all these animations all over it. That's fine. I think it certainly has a place, but I think that's so oversaturated at this point. And then you've got this kind of middle bucket of people that are scientists or are doctors and are trying to show people, okay, well, if we look at all these different studies, this is the conclusion that we can come to. And then there's this last bucket that I'm trying to fill, and I think that you are as well, is that it's not just about just, hey, here's the study. It's how, let's go into the study. Let's understand the methods. Let's understand all these different aspects. And I think that's one area that we're really missing, more people getting into it. And it really takes a fine crafting of teaching, understanding that some people don't have this science background, while also not letting go of too many of those details.
We've done an amazing job at that. You know, I find that I have a similar sentiment, which is that there's a large gap between what is taught about science and health sciences, whether we're talking about encounters in medicine or what's put out there that's publicly available, and where science is actually at. So maybe a good place to start would be by asking you, are there things that you've seen come out over the last, say, like 5 years in the scientific literature, things that are maybe lesser known, that are not really out there in the science education world, that people really should know about?
Yes. So something, there's always going to be a few things that jump off the page. But one thing, because we had a kind of a priming conversation before we started recording, actually, about the carbohydrate insulin model, which, so there's the thing that I would say, and which has been incredibly pervasive, is that carbohydrates are not inherently fattening. And the added information that I would throw in there that is not very well known is that there are actually hormones that are stimulated by the consumption of fat, like they are, like carbohydrates in stimulate insulin. So people get so focused on insulin, and it's certainly an incredibly important hormone, not to say anything against that, but it really only looks at half of the equation. The other half is, if you were to, let's say, massively cut down your carbohydrate intake, and you were to suddenly pump up your fat intake, so in an energy balance situation, then what happens hormonally? Well, there are some hormones that actually get affected specifically by lipid consumption, which is something that I rarely do I ever see anybody mention that. I'll give some credit to Dr. Lane Norton, who actually talked about this particular hormone called ASP, so acylation stimulating protein. And that protein is a really difficult protein to measure, but it is a hormone that is specifically affected by fat consumption. It affects fat uptake into the fat cells in terms of like actual lipogenesis and all that stuff. It drastically reduces lipolysis. But again, it's just such a difficult hormone to test and to measure, that just having the general, just telling people, hey, there's more than insulin out there, and carbohydrates aren't inherently fattening, can drastically change a person's perspective of, okay, if I'm just hearing about insulin, I think maybe I should be kind of branching out and seeing some other conversations about people that will talk about some of the other hormones, because it makes a big difference.
Absolutely. You know, it's always, I always reflect on that problem. What's out there that we don't know about? And that applies in the clinic as well. So in other words, we have our standard batches of tests that we do in medicine. And fasting insulin is not routinely one of them. But if it was possible to measure these other types of proteins in a cost-effective manner, how would that change the way that we think about energy balance and human disease? Like, what would we be catching that we're not catching right now? How would we change our guidance to people? So that's a fascinating kind of topic. What have you seen out there in the literature suggesting are really the fundamental underlying mechanisms? Is that primarily an energy balance problem, or is it a more complex endocrine problem from the start?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. That's tough. I certainly won't pretend like I've read every study on the hormonal aspects of insulin resistance, but I have looked at a good amount of mechanistic research on insulin resistance, as well as the general effect that different nutrients have on insulin resistance. So yes, I think one thing I can say for certain is that the energy balance issue is definitely a massive contributor to insulin resistance. I don't think that can really be questioned at this point, considering we have probably hundreds of studies that show that to be the case. That said, should we boil it all down to just the energy balance problem? Probably not. I think that there are definitely other aspects. So I'll give you an example. Like, I've looked at some of the mechanistic literature looking at saturated fat intake on insulin resistance, and there are some, obviously we shouldn't just be limiting to just mechanistic research when looking at particular nutrients, but there are some clinical trials as well showing that saturated fat intake, and of course it's going to depend on the saturated fat, but let's talk about the most ubiquitous one, like palmitate. So palmitate is found in so many different foods, and it's in varying concentrations, but certain foods have much higher levels of this palmitate, and that has a direct effect on insulin resistance. And the way that it does that is by it enters into our cells. So the palmitate molecule, the actual fatty acid itself, the fat molecule enters into our cells. And then from there, if it accumulates, it gets converted to these diacylglycerols, as well as the ceramide molecules. And those ceramide molecules and diacylglycerol molecules then can have an effect on the insulin signaling cascade. So it specifically has an effect on a protein called PKC, and that PKC molecule then can phosphorylate or kind of inhibit the activity of some of the actual insulin cascade molecules that would normally be needed to function to actually translate that insulin signaling inside the cell. So one of the chief molecules that it inhibits is IRS. So when, I know you know this, but for the audience, when insulin binds to the exterior of the cell where the insulin receptor is, you get this conformational change. So the actual insulin receptor will slightly change its shape, which gets sensed on the inside of the cells, because the insulin doesn't actually come inside the cell. It just attaches to the outside. So the inside of the cell then gets this slight shift. And then from there, you have this IRS molecule or this protein that binds to that region, and then it gets a further translation of the signal into the cell to then lead to, you know, these different transporters to go to the top of the membrane and all that stuff. I don't need to go into it. But the point is that this IRS molecule now gets blocked. So it's incapable of actually interacting, or even if it interacts, it gets phosphorylated or tagged in a certain way that stops the further signaling downstream. So that's one example that's not necessarily energy balance related, although obviously an accumulation of fatty acids in general will also lead to this effect. But if we were to start to get into some of the nitty gritty, start looking at some of these specific saturated fats, then you start to see this effect. So it's definitely far more complex than energy balance, but I think energy balance is one of the main drivers of insulin resistance.
And I have that sense as well, based on my review of the literature. Do you have a sense of, so you mentioned palmitate. One of the top level mechanisms where insulin resistance can begin has to do with triacylglycerols or triglycerides or fat that is stored within the muscle tissue itself. And those may be different kinds of fatty acids, but do you have a sense of whether this has to do more with saturated fat intake, or is it simply the presence of those lipids nearby that is causing insulin resistance to happen within the cell? In other words, are we just seeing the effects of potentially a saturated fatty acid that happens to be kind of a bystander just in the proximity of where insulin resistance is happening, rather than actual dietary intake?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So we know, at least I'll say that I'm leaning more towards saturated fat having a direct impact. And the reason why I say that is because there are some clinical studies that have looked at calorie-equated situations, but they only shift the saturated fat intake or the unsaturated fat intake. And the saturated fat intake groups across a multitude of studies, but there's probably more that have come out, because I looked at this maybe 3 years ago, that the groups that consumed saturated fat, they did a bunch of muscle biopsies, they did a bunch of stuff. There's this one study that was really well done where they increased saturated fat intake or they increased unsaturated fat intake, and then did a bunch of biopsies to actually do some of these molecular measures on the insulin cascade that we were just talking about, the ceramide increase, the diacylglycerol, triacylglycerol, all that stuff. And what they found is that consistently the saturated fat intake, again, it was focused on palmitate, because I think there may be some distinctions on the type of saturated fat, which I'm not educated enough to speak on that. But specifically talking about palmitate, that there was this dysregulation suddenly that directly occurred, with the only manipulation was this change in saturated fat versus unsaturated fat.
I've also seen some studies regarding peripheral mechanisms of insulin sensitization. So for example, GLP levels. So the question of the research studies being, how do we maximally stimulate GLP-1 secretion? And for the audience, GLP-1 is a molecule that sensitizes the body to insulin. It also has several effects on various parts of the brain to inhibit appetite. It's basically what these new weight loss drugs like Ozempic and all of that class of medications are based upon are essentially GLP-1 analogs. One of the interesting studies that I had seen recently was a variation of the saturated fatty acid type, whether it was saturated or polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fatty acids, having a relatively good effect on the amount of GLP-1 secretion. Do you think that maybe there's another endocrine mechanism that may be playing in, such as GLP-1 with these saturated fatty acids versus all the other classes?
Okay, first of all, I will say I've not looked at that literature. I've looked at GLP-1 literature, and I know that you've looked at it extensively because I've watched some of your videos on it. Again, really fantastic work. I definitely haven't looked at the literature that specifically looked at saturated fat versus unsaturated on GLP-1, but I would find it difficult to imagine a scenario where there isn't an effect of the type of saturated fat that you consume and its effects on any sort of endocrine measures. So if that's, you know, leptin, if that's GLP-1, if that's glucagon as a whole, any number of different hormones. So that's my best educated guess, but I haven't actually looked at that literature.
I reflect on a number of cases that I've had in the emergency department where people will come in presenting with dehydration, frequent urination, just kind of feeling lousy. We'll take their blood glucose and it's like 300, and all they had for breakfast was like some eggs. And so at that time they have new onset diabetes, and they may be in their 40s, they may be in their 60s or 70s. Regardless, when I encounter those types of patients, I often reflect upon the fact that we do have assays, we do have tests that could be used to detect this like probably 10 years, if not more, in advance. So in other words, for the audience, there are hormonal changes that happen in the body that characterize insulin resistance before it gets to full-blown diabetes. So I consider diabetes to be more of an end-stage diagnosis of a process that's been brewing for quite a long time. So we talked about how we kind of get there through insulin resistance. And then once enough insulin resistance develops, then your blood sugar becomes unregulated. And you can get downstream complications from that. When we have, you've done an episode that was fascinating recently. When someone is diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, meaning not the autoimmune kind of diabetes, but the kind that develops over time, usually as a result of energy imbalance. What is the data that we know about on reversing type 2 diabetes, how possible or feasible it is for most people? And then taking a step back to a more common problem, insulin resistance, what do we know about reversing that?
Yeah, so again, I won't pretend like I've looked at all the literature on the topic, but there is some really interesting literature coming out of England by Professor Roy Taylor, if anybody's interested in looking him up. He does a bunch of, he's released several studies on this concept known as the personal fat threshold and the how to actually reverse type 2 diabetes. And essentially, just in short, the personal fat threshold is on a very high level that every person has a particular threshold that if they hit that threshold, that they then will develop type 2 diabetes. And that can be at a relatively low body fat. Like if you were to see somebody walking along, on the street, you'd think, oh, well, that person's not overweight. So therefore, there's probably the odds are low that they have diabetes. That's typically true, but it is possible for them to develop diabetes. And that may be because their personal fat threshold is quite low. So they hit a certain percentage and then their risk increases substantially. While for other people, their personal fat threshold may be much higher and they have to be pretty severely overweight for them to actually really start to experience a huge risk in diabetes. So that was the general notion that he had first attacked, and he was trying to pull together some data to corroborate that. And then from there, he did a study just a few years ago where he put people on a highly restrictive, just calorie-restricted diet that wasn't really restricted on any particular macronutrient. It was just severely calorically restricted and had people go through these cycles of this this very low calorie diet, and then they were able to go back up to their maintenance level for a number of weeks, and then they went back into another cycle of this this strong calorie deficit. And then from there, they measured their diabetes outcome. So if that was, they looked at like VLDL, they looked at blood glucose levels, looked at insulin levels, looked at HbA1c and whatnot. And they showed that they were able to put diabetes into remission in these individuals. And what was, there were a few things that were striking about that. First, most individuals, I think the percentage was something like 70%, were able to completely eliminate all drugs after that point, and were able to then manage their diabetes. The second thing was that not everyone experiences that much of a benefit, and it really depends on the time that a person has had diabetes. So they had identified, I think it was just like maybe 6 years, if you've been diabetic for like 5 or 6 years, you're starting to get into that gray zone where it's becomes more and more difficult to I don't want to say that you can't improve it. Of course, you can improve it. Always you can improve it. But to a point where your blood glucose levels start to enter back to more of that normal range, which is a huge regression in your diabetes status. And on top of that, some people, they did mention that there were exceptions. So some people, even if they'd been diabetic for 25 years, they were still able to pull all the way back to roughly normal levels. Now, that said, I did have some critiques of that study in that, on average, what they actually ended up showing is that people were able to regress it back to just about pre-diabetic levels. So some people were able to get it back down, because we're talking about averages here. So some people did experience basically a complete remission back down to normal blood glucose levels and normal insulin levels, which is absolutely mind-blowing and incredible. But for the most part, it was usually back down to about pre-diabetic levels, which tells me that a person is able to combat it effectively, able to maybe, you could maybe argue, put it into remission, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're completely healed of the disease. So that was just by mere calorie restriction, losing body weight, losing body fat. There are probably other metrics and other ways that you could do it. I'm just not educated on that.
And the personal fat threshold, do you have a sense of whether that's total body fat? I haven't reviewed that literature, but is that total body fat? Is it visceral fat? Is it looking at hepatic or liver fat?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the main thing that they focused on was the hepatic fat, because the hepatic fat would have an effect then on the pancreas, which would then have this like looping mechanism of where you have this, I believe at first it was like an increase in blood glucose levels, but then you had an insensitivity in the pancreas to then secrete insulin, and then it gets overcome. So eventually you have this greater and greater secretion of insulin, and that's where you get this steady rise in fasting insulin levels. So it's just this constant feedback back and forth between the two. But the starting point, according to Dr. Taylor, which of course he would know better than I would, but according to his paper that he released, it seems to start out at the liver.
Yeah, that is fascinating research. I always encourage patients that I see if caught early enough, this is currently known to be a somewhat reversible disease process. How would someone know if they're insulin resistant?
Yeah, there's a number of different metrics that you could use. So I guess I'll walk through a few of them. The most basic and probably the least precise is to do a HOMA-IR calculation. So that would just be your blood glucose versus your insulin levels. That can give you a pretty good indication, but it's not exactly perfect. For a better indication or more advanced technique, you could use something, at least in research, which I know it's clinically available as well, although it's certainly more cumbersome. You could look at something like an oral glucose tolerance test. So where they give 75 grams of glucose, sugar, and then see how your body reacts to it, how much insulin gets secreted, and then on top of that, how much of a drop in blood sugar that you see and how quickly it happens, a bunch of different metrics. And then if you really wanted to go extreme, you could do an insulin clamp test, which is where the researchers would be clamping the amount of insulin that they put into the system to see how much insulin is necessary to actually see the retrieval or the your cells are sucking out how much glucose. So I did a poor job explaining that. You have a certain amount of blood glucose in your system, and there's a certain amount of insulin that gets secreted by your pancreas. If it's a very low amount of insulin that gets secreted from your pancreas and you're able to clear out glucose out of your bloodstream, think about it like a two-compartment model. Your cells are on the periphery, so that's one compartment, so like the muscle cells, for example. And then you've got the other compartment, which is the bloodstream itself. So the bloodstream is filled with this glucose, and the insulin sensitivity is the actual removal of the blood glucose into the other compartment, the cells themselves. So what they do is, or I guess I'll talk about the physiology real quick. So if you have a very small amount of insulin that gets secreted and all that blood glucose goes into the musculature, that's fantastic. You have really high insulin sensitivity. But the more and more insulin that's needed, more of those molecules are needed to get the same exact reaction. It means you become less and less insulin sensitive or more insulin resistant. So what they're doing with this test is that they're putting in a certain amount of insulin, for example, and they're seeing, or a certain amount of glucose, there's a few different ways to do it. And then they want to know, okay, well, if we put in this amount of, let's say, insulin, how much glucose is actually being removed out of the bloodstream? And this is a very tightly controlled experiment as well. So it's probably far beyond what anybody actually needs to do. They could probably do a HOMA-IR or maybe an oral glucose tolerance test. And if they wanted to look at some long-term measures, they could look at HbA1c, but that, you know, doesn't necessarily always tell a full story. But I think the first starting point would be blood sugar levels. And on top of that, making sure that you're looking at your insulin levels as well.
Now, when you say blood sugar levels, one thing I've been pretty curious about, because CGMs or continuous glucose monitors are becoming very popular and potentially hold some promise. I've looked through some of the studies on CGMs in terms of, do they tell you meaningful information about whether you're insulin resistant? And so far, I have not come to a firm conclusion, because some of the studies out there are industry funded, so it's kind of hard to discern. But they're looking relatively promising. What are your thoughts on that? Have you seen any data on CGMs and whether it can be used as kind of a, like the insulin, rather the glucose spike can be used as a proxy for insulin resistance?
Yeah, I haven't looked into it to any great degree. It's actually something I just started looking into myself. But my intuition is that, yeah, probably the spike could tell you something, but I think it depends on the frequency of the spike, how high the spike is. Because, I mean, some people, they, you know, if their habit in general is just to be consuming like one meal a day, of course, they're going to probably have a pretty big spike. Mm-hmm. And that's just because of the nature of how they consume their food, not necessarily because they have any sort of blood sugar regulation issue. So I think that I'm a little on the fence. I think I'm, again, pretty uneducated on the topic. So I'd have to really finish reading those studies to be 100% or at least 99% certain.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably a valuable use of CGMs, is looking at the blood sugar variation and spikes. There's some really fascinating research out there that looked at endothelial function as a function of, you know, the question was, does endothelial function and blood flow vary based upon whether you have chronically elevated glucose levels versus intermediately elevated glucose levels versus high and then low, or oscillating is what we called it, glucose levels. And in fact, they presented a pretty convincing story that in fact oscillating glucose levels are potentially problematic to the endothelium. So that was some pretty interesting research. I want to see more of that. On that topic of glucose levels, you know, back in med school, we would always be taught that diabetes is problematic because of the glucose. It was really not much mention about insulin, and that was in the late 2000s, probably, well, 2011 or so. We've gained a lot of insight since that time. So the story at that time was diabetes is problematic because glucose is too high, and that glycosylates proteins or various different macromolecules like collagen to impair wound healing. There is an adverse effect on the endothelium, causing plaque buildup. And as you know, one of the more common causes of death in the U.S. is heart disease and ASCVD, strokes, etc. But because we've gone into all the mechanisms of, or many of the mechanisms of insulin resistance and how to reverse it, etc., we may talk a little bit about, like, why is insulin resistance bad? Like, why should people even care about it? What long-term effects does it have on someone's health that are important for them to know about?
Yeah, so there's, it's bad through so many different mechanisms. I guess a lot of the research that I've looked at has been mitochondria focused, but I think that it extends far beyond just mitochondria. If you think of insulin resistance, it's actually very much to your point early on, talking about how insulin resistance is kind of the beginning of leading up to diabetes, which is this long-standing condition. It's not like it just pops up out of nowhere. Insulin resistance, the way I understand it, or at least through some of the mechanisms that I've seen, is that you have this overburdened cell. The cell is just filled with nutrients or overfilled with nutrients to the point where it can't function nearly as well. And that's through some of this, some of these conversions to these other molecules. You can also have a deposition of fat at different regions of the cell that can be more or less advantageous to the cell. So an example of that would be like we store triglycerides. So with the fat molecules that you were mentioning earlier on, these fat molecules can be stored at the sarcolemmal level, or they can be stored at the kind of the deeper recesses of the cell. So for anybody listening, sarcolemmal level would be at the cell membrane, so the very top region of the cell, or it can be in the deeper recesses of the cell nearer to the mitochondria. And the location of that fat actually makes quite a big difference, in that the location of the fat can really inform you on if you are potentially athletically inclined or you've been exercising a lot, because the deeper recesses of fat are actually positively correlated to health. And the ones that are higher up, more sarcolemmal, those are, you can think of them almost like just these excess fat depots that the cell is just trying to place this fat somewhere because it has nowhere else to put it. So what I'm saying in total is that you're just getting this buildup of these nutrients, which is ultimately leading to changes in the cell signaling, which is not just affecting the insulin cascade, it's also affecting, for example, your mitochondrial health. So you tend to have more oxidative stress, simply because your oxidative stress, for those unaware, is the overgeneration of these potentially damaging molecules like reactive oxygen species. And the reason for that is, again, if you think of, let's think of mitochondria as this powerhouse of the cell that generates this energy. You have on the beginning stages, you have this whole depot of energy that needs to be converted into actual energy. So it's like pre-energy. It's just these nutrients. It's just fat nutrients or molecules. It can be glucose as well. And that gets stored inside the cell, and the mitochondria then sucks up these fat molecules and these glucose molecules and will then convert them to ATP or cellular energy. Now, it can only do that at a certain rate. So if it's necessitous for it to generate energy, then it'll do that, but it only do that at a certain rate. Now, if you are over-consuming, if we go back to the overconsumption aspect, if you are over-consuming, those cells get so saturated with nutrients that the mitochondria simply can't go through all of those nutrients. But that drive, that overall high level of nutrients within the cell can lead to what's known as electron slippage. So you start to have these oxidative stress molecules that start to get produced by the mitochondria, and because it simply can't deal with that amount of nutrients. And of course, that's going to have wide-reaching effects across the cell. So you start to, if we pull out of the cell, out of the inside of the cell, and we think of reactive oxygen species, and we're talking about mass amounts of reactive oxygen species, not a small amount, because those can actually be quite beneficial. but we're talking about mass amounts of reactive oxygen species can lead to different gene changes within the cell. So if we go to like one of your examples with the endothelial cells will then change their inflammatory profile. So they'll start secreting more of these pro-inflammatory cytokines, these different molecules that attract more immune cells to that region. They'll change their gene expression to start creating more of these ICAM proteins and VCAM proteins, which essentially allow immune cells to then grab onto the endothelial cells and then to potentially invade past the endothelial cells, which starts the process of atherosclerosis, or one of the mechanisms by which atherosclerosis occurs. So it's when you think about insulin resistance, it's not just insulin. Oh, we can't get glucose in, which is a huge factor. I mean, that's no doubt about it. But there's so many other things that it starts to affect, and you could go to from tissue to tissue to tissue, where you start having maybe plaque formation in the brain. You could start having, I don't know, the liver doesn't function as well. It's inundated with triglycerides. So now it starts to affect the pancreas. If we go back to Roy Taylor's example, I mean, there's just so many different ways. I mean, we could talk about it for 10 plus hours, you know?
Exactly. I 100% agree. That's fascinating. I had never heard that story. I was not aware about that data of insulin resistance at that level. I had always thought about it through the more traditional insulin signaling cascade and the potential malignancy potentiation, like prostate cancer, et cetera. You know, you review a lot of these big studies, epidemiology studies, and they have metabolic syndrome as one of the greatest risk factors for heart disease, even outweighing other more traditional risk factors at times, depending upon the study. So you mentioned the connection with mitochondria. That may be a good segue to kind of get into that a little bit. When I was in graduate school, I would often talk with one of my colleagues about mitochondrial health and disease. And at that time, mitochondria were a big focus of molecular research, which I know you have done a lot of. And it was a big topic because many of the diseases that we know about in human health converge in some way or another on mitochondrial dysfunction. And I've always been very curious in wanting to know, is that causative? Is there a therapeutic or intervention target that is possible at the level of mitochondria? Or is that something where once a disease has progressed to the point where it's advanced enough to be clinically noticeable that the mitochondria are also affected at that time? In other words, do you think for many of these diseases that we hear about mitochondrial involvement, do you think the mitochondria are upstream or downstream or somewhere in the middle?
Let me walk back a few steps. So you're absolutely right. A lot of the research has started to focus on mitochondrial dysfunction. It's probably been that way for a number of years now. Unfortunately, though, it's funny because I was talking to my mentor in my PhD, and he was saying that back in like the early 2000s and the 90s and whatnot, so much of the research was related to the endoplasmic reticulum dysfunction. So it's like, just you know, it's just kind of shifted from one organelle to another organelle, which is funny, but it also, to me, it creates this pause of like, are we yet again focusing on just a single factor, and then to the dismissal of all the other factors, which I think as biologists and as physiologists we should have learned our lesson by now that it seems like everything is so interconnected. And not to say that you can't look at a single factor, but to reduce every disease down to a single factor. And this is coming from a person who's spent the last 7-8 years looking at mitochondria. I'm just extremely reluctant to then say, oh, it's all about mitochondria, because you will, if you go to research conferences, I'm sure you have, but researchers just get so focused on what they're researching that they think, oh, well, I have found the problem with all disease or with all these different diseases and whatnot. And I just don't know how accurate that is. That said, there's plenty of literature that does link mitochondrial dysfunction to a whole host of different disease states. I sure hope that's the case, because my PhD defense is going to be very difficult if I end up saying something otherwise. So to answer your more specific question of, is it upstream or is it downstream? Honestly, I don't fully know. I know that if you specifically target, there's plenty of studies that have specifically targeted mitochondria and damage them in one way or another. And then you do see actual cell damage, like it starts to really affect the cell. And then that, of course, if you extend that outwards millions of times over, that starts to affect the whole entire body. So no doubt mitochondria are directly implicated in disease. But I think most likely there's probably other organelles that also play a factor, or it can be upstream, where you have these different signaling proteins that may lead to some sort of dysfunction to mitochondria, but the actual dysfunction started somewhere else. You have other areas of oxidation that are beyond mitochondria. Nobody talks about organelles like the peroxisome, which are kind of like these cousins of mitochondria. So there's just like, you could make arguments in all kinds of different directions, but I think that the answer is probably, if I had to guess, probably a lot more holistic than just looking at mitochondria as the cause of everything.
Mm-hmm. And are there specific examples of diseases where you see mitochondrial dysfunction and you can kind of bring that back from the brink by a therapy that targets mitochondria? Do we have any examples of those?
Yeah, there are. So I'm definitely not going to remember the name of the disease, but there are certain ocular diseases. If I remember, I did some research for some of the insiders so some people end up working with me, just asking questions and whatnot. So I end up doing a little bit of research for them. And one person asked me, because they're suffering from this particular ocular disease, which is like Lon, I think, L-O-N-H. It's something hereditary, but it's specific to mitochondria. And there is some research looking at potentially reintroducing more functional mitochondria and how that can have a dramatic effect in improving that person's vision and just their overall quality of life. So that's one example. There have been other studies where they've done like mitochondrial transplantation studies, specifically in mice. So these are preclinical studies, and they've shown some improvement. I would guess that in indirect ways with diabetes, for example, because if you have diabetes for long enough, you start to have these dramatic, like essentially all your mitochondria are differently shaped, different function. I mean, they're just ruined essentially. But if you could maybe transplant new mitochondria in that situation, and obviously change the environment as well, so a person would have to, you know, get on a better diet and all these different things, that I do think that it's possible to be able to maybe reverse even further than what would be innately possible if you didn't replace the mitochondria and just did the diet intervention, just did the exercise intervention, which both of those have tremendous effects at improving mitochondrial health. So yeah, I think that there's a whole host of different disease states that I think could be improved by specifically targeting mitochondria. But again, I just don't want people to think that if we just focus on mitochondria, that then all the other problems will suddenly get erased. Because I just don't, my experience so far as a physiologist is just, it's just almost never the case. Everything is so interconnected.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, in many of these diseases, there are reasons why mitochondria have pathology. There are upstream processes happening. I really often think about like VO2 max, and I'm sure you're aware, and much of the audience is aware, of the extraordinarily tight correlation between VO2 max that is inversely related to the risk of death. And I always wonder about that, because we know exercise is so important for mitochondria, and it's like, how much is that a proxy measure versus, you know, a composite measure? I mean, much more on the composite measure side of things, in terms of like, what is your general biological state? I think it's a great tool. But to a similar point, I'm wondering, so maybe for let me back up a little bit. Mitochondrial biology is kind of a new emerging field, as far as I can tell, we're finally understanding what it means, some of these things that happen to mitochondria that we see in the lab, whether they're changing shape or fragmenting or undergoing mitophagy. For someone who wants to read mitochondrial literature and understand the context of research findings, so let's say the authors report shape changes in mitochondria as a result of a particular intervention or increased mitochondrial biogenesis or increased mitophagy, can you tell us a bit about what's the life of a mitochondria? What signifies good mitochondrial health? What signifies, what does bad mitochondrial health look like? What does it mean when these break apart and change shapes? What does it mean when they undergo mitophagy or mitochondrial biogenesis?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So let me back up real quick and kind of offer this kind of on the general scientific landscape. Is I even alluded to it before that we shouldn't just be focused on mechanistic studies when looking at the overall healthcare of a person. And I think that's also true when we over extrapolate what happens to mitochondria. So what we should be doing is looking at randomized controlled trials for the overall health of a person, meta-analyses, things like that. You can even look at correlation studies, but obviously there's certain limitations to that, just like any other study. But the point is that you're looking at hard outcomes. You're typically trying to look at either biomedical markers like LDL, ApoB, all that stuff, blood sugar, insulin, or you're looking at actual hard outcomes of cardiovascular events like actual heart attack or mortality and whatnot. Those are actual hard outcomes that you can tell, oh, well, that's not good. Okay, fair enough. I think the same thing should be applied to, let's say, mitochondria. Instead of looking at mitochondrial shape and then saying, well, that's not a healthy mitochondrion, I think that's pretty short-sighted. And yet I see a lot of researchers do that. They don't actually, and what they'll often do is if you read a paper by them, a review or whatever it might be, or in the discussion section, they'll be like, well, mitochondria were more fragmented with palmitate addition, which is something else that I've done in the lab. So you add palmitate to the cells, the mitochondria will quickly, very rapidly fragment where they become really small. And then they'll say, well, because of this fragmentation, we also see that in other studies, it's correlated with diabetes, it's correlated with obesity and whatnot. And that's all well and good. I'm not debating that, but it still doesn't mean that the fragmentation itself is somehow negative. It could just be an adaptation to the intervention that you just added. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's negative. It could. So which we should be doing is looking at some actual markers. So an example of that would be looking at reactive oxygen species generation. If you suddenly start seeing a massive increase in reactive oxygen species, and we know exactly what reactive oxygen species do, they damage everything around them, again, when they're overabundant, then that's obviously, then you know, okay, now we're dealing with a dysfunctional mitochondrion. Or if ATP generation suddenly plummets, then you know, okay, that's probably not good either. There's some sort of dysfunction that's happening. So those are actual measures of dysfunction as opposed to just looking at the size or the amount of mitophagy, which is the autophagy of mitochondria, the clearing out of mitochondria, or the amount of biogenesis. Which are proxy markers, and they're interesting, and they can tell you a story, and they can fit in and could be good or could be bad. But I just like to go more directly to the source than rather than focusing on just those metrics, you know.
When someone says mitochondrial biogenesis, what do they mean?
So mitochondrial biogenesis is simply the creation of new mitochondria. So the mitochondria they go through, obviously they can change their shape as we just talked about, right? So they can fragment, which undergoes a process known as fission. So you have a mitochondrion, which is usually not the bean shape that people think of, but it's usually very tubular. And what will happen is you have these proteins that come in called DRP1, and they will literally create a collar around the mitochondrion. And then they'll start, just massive use of energy. They just use a ton of GTP. So that's another form of energy for anybody listening. So we know of ATP, that's the main form of energy energy that the cell uses. We have a secondary currency. We actually have a tertiary as well, but this is the main secondary one is GTP. So this DRP1 protein will create this collar. It's like, think of like maybe 50 GTP or 50 DRP1 proteins that will create this collar around mitochondria. And then those proteins will attach to GTP molecules and hydrolyze them or break them into GDP. And the release of that energy allows the collar to then shrink. And it keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until the DRP1 proteins have completely severed a mitochondrion from another one. And that's how we get that fragmentation. So this goes to biogenesis in just a second. So that fragmentation, or the actual what's called fission, mitochondrial fission, then allows you to create new mitochondria. So if you have this really long mitochondrion and then you need to create a new mitochondrion, you can undergo that process and generate a new mitochondrion, because now you have two technically, right? You had this one really long one, and then you had and now you have two smaller ones, but you can start to import other proteins to extend both of them and create two, you know, equally long ones again. So that's one of the processes by which we can undergo biogenesis. We've got a bunch of other proteins that are also involved in the process, like PGC1 alpha is one of the main ones that a lot of people focus on.
You have a sense of, so there's a lot of talk out there about how exercise increases mitochondrial biogenesis, mitochondrial capacity. You have a sense of a mechanism for how that's working?
Yes. So there's probably a number of different ways that exercise increases mitochondrial biogenesis. No doubt, I'll go out on a limb and say at the very least, the majority of them run through this PGC1 alpha mechanism that I was briefly mentioned. So PGC1 alpha is this protein. You can think of it like, maybe your audience, I know you have, but maybe your audience has heard of like mTOR or AMPK. These are these master proteins that have such tremendous effects across the entire cell and affect all these different cell signaling cascades that they're basically, they're immutable. You have to have them. They have to exist. Otherwise, the whole cell just becomes incredibly defunct and it essentially dies. Well, PGC1 alpha is essentially that for mitochondria and really the birth of other organelles as well, but primarily mitochondria. So if you have this upregulation of PGC1 alpha, then that can lead to what's known as like a translocation, or these different signaling proteins will then go from the cytosol, or kind of the inside of the cell that's outside of the nucleus where our genes are actually kept. And so PGC1 alpha will affect these signaling proteins to then go inside of the nucleus and bind to mitochondria-specific genes. So these translocation proteins will then bind to these mitochondria-specific genes and will then allow for the reading machinery, so what's known as the polymerase, to come in and then create the different transcripts. And I won't go into all the details on that, but it's just a bunch of RNA, which ultimately then escapes the nucleus, goes back into the cytosol, and then gets turned into these proteins. And those proteins are, again, they've specifically been read from mitochondrial genes, so therefore you get the generation of these mitochondrial proteins. And on top of that, they have these tags on them, which are these mitochondrial translocation sequences. So the tag then tells the cell where to place that protein. And usually it's this polypeptide, so it hasn't been folded together into the functional protein. So this polypeptide chain with this tag attached to it will go to a mitochondrion that maybe has that's a very small one that's just fizzed off of, that's just been fragmented off of a mature one, and will then be imported into the mitochondrion. And then that sequence, the targeting sequence, will be cleaved off. And then you have the folding of these different these proteins to then create this mature mitochondrion. And exercise has a role in that through There's a bunch of signaling cascades that can have an effect on PGC1 alpha directly to encourage it to be produced or for its activity. Or we talked about it, reactive oxygen species. So people often think of that as a negative always, but exercise actually increases reactive oxygen species in a very quick, it's just like a bump in reactive oxygen species, which then gets eliminated because exercise also increases antioxidants like glutathione. Which then eliminates those reactive oxygen species. So the ROS will actually interact with some of these signaling proteins, which will then directly affect PGC1 alpha. So there's many other mechanisms as well, but that's kind of the main road that they go by.
So kind of moving into actionable items. Mm-hmm. So we talked about exercise. A couple of questions here. Are there things that people can be doing that are part of daily life for most people that affect mitochondrial health or harms mitochondrial health? So we talked about exercise. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on exercise intensity, like zone 2 versus higher intensity exercises, and then nutritional factors and et cetera.
So definitely exercise is a huge component, which I knew it gets repetitive because people that are really into this space, I'm sure they've heard that 1,000 times before. It's nothing new, but I think people should take solace in that it's not going to change. The science is 100% clear. Absolutely. It's the way it's going to be. And if a person listens to a science-minded person like your channel, you're going to get a lot of repetition of the same stuff because it's not about like going, oh, something glitzy is over here, so I'm just going to start saying this. It's always consistently true that exercise is a factor. Now, you can get into the nuances to your point about like zone 2, or you can go into more intense versions of exercise and whatnot. To be honest, I have not looked into that literature, so I can't specifically say, oh, well, one is going to be better than the other. What I can say is that cardiovascular exercise tends to be a little bit better for mitochondria than strength training, and strength training is near and dear to my heart, so that pains me to say, but still, like, mitochondria tend to get a little bit better of a response from cardiovascular training, and that's probably because, as you mentioned before, with VO2 max and VO2, the impact that oxygen consumption has on mitochondria, there is this strong relationship between oxygen consumption and mitochondria. So that's probably one massive factor, this cardiovascular training. Exact intensity, I can't speak to that yet. Other things, being weight stable, huge. If you are within a normal range, it doesn't have to be super strict. It's not like you have to have a six pack or anything like that, but just keeping yourself relatively normal weight. I know BMI isn't the greatest metric, but you can kind of tell if you have some muscularity to you, you have a little bit of body fat, that's fine. Again, you don't have to have a six pack or anything like that, but just being slim, being active, that's going to be probably the most ideal scenario. So keeping yourself normal weight, the types of foods that you consume. So there are probably going to be some nuances there. Again, looking at like unsaturated fats or polyunsaturated fats, specifically looking at like omega-3 fats tend to be really beneficial for a whole host of different things. Again, probably not news to most people. They hear that all the time. If that's DHA or EPA, both of them have different benefits that they come. I think EPA is a little bit more cardiovascular disease focused, which I haven't looked at that research in any great depth, but I have looked at DHA quite a lot. DHA has significant effects for the brain. So I think that having more of these polyunsaturated fats can have a tremendous effect. Monounsaturated fats can also have positives, like olive oil, that kind of ilk. You can get more unsaturated fats from like avocados. I don't want to demonize saturated fats completely. There are some certain saturated fats that are deemed to be pretty beneficial, like butyrate, I believe is one of them. That tends to be a shorter chain saturated fatty acid, which tends to have benefits. And again, we're getting beyond my scope in terms of the intricacies within saturated fat, but certainly palmitate and I believe stearate is another one that seems to have pretty negative effects across the cell, but certainly on mitochondria. So, and it's you can't avoid them entirely. It's just really about proportions. You just want to lessen them. Just keep in mind, just lessen, but don't, you know, don't super focus on, oh, this has 10% stearate, this has 11% palmitate, whatever it might be. So those are kind of some general things that come to mind. I think that there probably will be more that I think of. Supplements, actually, I'm not a huge supplement person myself. I take a few, but there's some interesting, really interesting research starting to come out, like clinical trials looking at GLYNAC supplementation, so glycine plus N-acetylcysteine. I'll go ahead and put a caveat here that the research has come out of one laboratory. It's a highly reputable laboratory, so that's great, but it's still only out of one laboratory. They did look at multiple, they had a pilot study, so with a smaller group of individuals, they showed some astounding results on mitochondrial health, and then they extended it out to a bigger trial, and they showed the same results, so in a whole nother sample. So that's really encouraging, but it's still, again, only one laboratory, so I'm kind of cautiously saying, you know, GLYNAC might be beneficial. People that have tried it have, or a lot of people that have had some problems with their health have tried it and seen some pretty tremendous effects. Of course, that's anecdotal. So I think that as I learn more about it over the next 10, 15 years, I'll probably have more specifics to say. But as it stands, it really just comes down to the basics. I mean, that's unfortunately and extremely fortunately, it really comes down to the basics.
I agree 100% that, you know, the basics are something that at least we can count on, right? Like exercise effects are not going to change, right? And you hit on something really important, which is that we have to be careful. The more mechanistic studies that come out, although they are fascinating, the more mechanistic studies that come out, the more tempted we may be to attribute positive health attributes, effects to certain specific pathways or molecules or supplements and et cetera. And it is critical to always go back to the human trials, the randomized clinical trials. So I'm glad you hit on that point. On a similar note, one of the more popular topics recently has been autophagy. I know you've done a lot of work on autophagy. It's kind of a similar problem with mitochondria, right? Because at least that's my sense, and I wanted to ask you about it because we see autophagy happening more or less when we vary certain conditions. And the meaning of that signal is a little bit unclear. I think it's been popularized recently because of intermittent fasting. But I'm wondering what your feelings are. If you think it's overhyped, if you think we just don't have a complete understanding of autophagy and what it means, or whether we haven't had a chance to tightly link it to clinical outcomes. What are your thoughts right now on that?
It is absolutely overhyped, 100% overhyped. I've published a few studies on autophagy, specifically a specific type of autophagy related to mitochondria. Again, that's the mitophagy that I mentioned earlier, but it goes through very similar mechanisms, so it's not going to be this, you know, massive difference. But in totality, you know, autophagy became really popular maybe, I guess, when was it, the Nobel Prize for that? It was like 2010 or something like that. It was relatively recently, within the last like decade or two. And then it really took off in social media land over the last like 3 to 5 years, something like that. It's just been all over the place. And the claims that are made are just staggeringly wild. So I would absolutely say it's been overhyped. It's certainly been misunderstood. And I think some people don't even understand it at all, and it's still overhyped. So that's one aspect. I think a lot of people get so focused on actually stimulating autophagy without actually creating this link of, does it actually lead to any sort of improvements in a particular clinical outcome or a particular health outcome and whatnot? And really, I mean, autophagy is happening all the time within your cells. It's being upregulated or increased, or it's being downregulated, it's being decreased at basically virtually every minute of the day. It's just constantly oscillating back and forth. And the idea in general is that what a lot of people are then assuming is that if you try to generally increase it more, that that's better. If you upregulate it more often, then that's better. And I think that there's this kind of attractive notion about it that it's this cellular cleanup process. So for anybody that's not familiar with autophagy, it's literally, in a really basic term, it's just these sacs within, these vacuoles within our cells that capture different components of our cell that need to be degraded, they need to be eliminated. So, and that's one version. There are other types like xenophagy and pexophagy and mitophagy and like, pexophagy, mitophagy, and all these different versions. So it's not just limited to just cleaning up the different proteins and different membranes and different organelles that are found within the cell that need to be eliminated. But I think people get so attracted to the idea of essentially cleaning house, right? Like if you're sick or if you're feeling bad, that this idea that your cells are creating this system that captures the bad components and eliminates them, that's like, yeah, it's like cleaning your house. It's like, it just makes you feel good, right? And people have attached that to, it's necessarily good. It's always good then. And that is completely untrue, that it is always good. If you are healthy and you decide to try to increase your autophagy, there's no problem with that necessarily. And it can be healthy, and it is correlated with certain metrics of health, like maybe losing body fat, for example, can change your autophagy and kind of increase your autophagy. So you know, that may not be a bad thing, that may be a good thing. But there are instances where autophagy can be extremely detrimental. Again, not necessarily because a person has stimulated it to be detrimental. It's just the nature of the beast. It's just a mechanism that can be extremely detrimental. I mean, there are examples in cancer, there are examples in obesity and diabetes where autophagy is upregulated, is increased, but it does all this damage, but nobody ever discusses that on social media because it doesn't feed into this really simple narrative of you're cleaning house and that's really great. You know, it's, at least that's my sense. I could be off on that.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I think oversimplifying any health science topic carries with it a lot of risk, which is why I really admire the work that you've done, because you're, again, able to carry this education with such a high degree of scientific rigor. And I really admire that. So people should definitely go check you out. Go check out Nick on his channel. I hope we can do this again in the near future. How can people find you?
Literally just type in Physionic, PHYSIONIC. That's it. It's you'll find me. I'm honestly, anytime, Nick, I can talk about science for hours and hours and hours.
I've learned a tremendous amount from you. So thank you so much, Nick.
I appreciate it.
All right, everyone, go check out Nick. And with that, thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.